This is a classic way of dealing with public criticism of governments like China and others.
China defends mass internment of Muslim minorities. It's Wednesday, October 17th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, will the path to North Korean denuclearization include sanctions relief? Unearthing Afghanistan's past. Trade tariff costs. Working outside. Relocating invasive species and a blind hiker finding a grand trail. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China is defending its mass internment of Muslim ethnic minorities, saying it is preventing terrorism by helping them improve job skills, by teaching them the Mandarin language, and encouraging them to accept modern science. A senior Chinese official made that argument in a report released Tuesday, the latest action in a broad campaign to defend its internment of Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other minorities in the face of growing criticism. The report, published by China's official Xinhua News Agency, said the ruling Communist Party's vision for the far western Xinjiang region is the assimilation of the indigenous Central Asian ethnic groups into Chinese culture and introducing them to a, quote, modern way of life. China's Communist Party has resisted Western pressure related to the internment camps, insisting it is a vast police pursuit and surveillance program, and it's needed to counter latent extremism and to maintain stability. Former detainees have described the facilities as political indoctrination camps, where they were forced to condemn Islam and declare loyalty to the Communist Party. Uyghur rights activist Nuri Turkel tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that he's not surprised.
This is expected, first of all. This is what the governments like China that have been brutal in oppressing its ethnic minorities like the Uyghurs, and also this is a classic way of dealing with public criticism of governments like China and others who have that applies a rather brutal method to deal with a political resentment in the societies. So, any reasonable people, if at all, expected the Chinese government to acknowledge that they have a 21st century Nazi-style concentration camps, and they have been criminalizing the Uyghur people based on their race and ethnicity and religion in 21st century, would be inconceivable. I don't think that anyone would expect something that decent from this government. If that decent government, if the Chinese government is that reasonable, that they're fair, we wouldn't be talking about or having this conversation in 2018 that the Uyghurs have been subject to internment camps and concentration camps, like a situation based on their Uyghur ethnicity and Islamic faith.
Is there any way out of this situation that you can see?
I like to be hopeful, but based on the Chinese government motives, I am not too optimistic that they will do something right to rectify this horrific situation. When you look at any internal or external conflicts, geography tells you or explains many of the unanswered questions. The Uyghurs' homeland sits in a large chunk of China proper, which is the size of four times the size of California, which is a gateway to China's access to Eurasian natural resources and market. And now with Xi Jinping's One Road, One Belt initiative, the Chinese ambition to achieve this global influence coercive influence campaign will not be realized without China having full control of this precious piece of territory or a property. This has a lot to do with China's global ambition. And then, two, Chinese government has been using rather disturbing terminology to express their plans. One is like final solution, spreading chemical to eradicate ideology, and Islam is a mental disease. So this explains that China perceives Uyghurs' ethno-national identity as a potential political threat that may destabilize China, that may weaken Xi Jinping's authority, that may weaken the Communist Party. And then finally, this has a lot of racism in it. The Chinese people and the Chinese government are having difficulty to come to grip with a painful reality, which is the Chinese culture or Chinese way of life or Chinese preference in cultural linguistic affairs are not something universal. As such, the Uyghurs and others, Tibetans and others, must accept and must adopt, must be converted into. So there's no other way of explaining why the Chinese government all of a sudden wanted to eradicate any ideology that cherishes Uyghurs' centuries-old ethno-national spiritual heritage. So because of this ambitious, unstated goal, I don't think the Chinese will back away. This is not a domestic Chinese affair. This is not a human rights issue. This is a globally concernable issue, because what we're seeing is in 2018, a government is repressing its people in concentration camps based on their religion, bias, and ethnicity. And if this works out, some other authoritarian regime will borrow the pages from Xi Jinping's playbook and will implement it. The Uyghurs' lives and Uyghurs' homeland have been used as a laboratory by the Chinese government. If not enough attention has been paid to this issue, the Chinese people will be waking up to their rude reality. This will be expanded to the other regions because it's working for the Chinese government.
Uyghur rights activist Nuri Turkel speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. The United Nations estimates about 1 million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other minorities have been arbitrarily detained in China. The UN said in August that the detentions were deeply disturbing. The bipartisan U.S. Congressional Executive Commission on China accused Beijing of initiating an unprecedented campaign to repress ethnic minorities and said such abuses may constitute crimes against humanity. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Three-way talks begin on disarming key part of Korean border. China wants to further boost ties in Central and East Europe. Caution, cancellations, protests as concerns grow on China's Belt and Road. China defends mass internment of Muslim ethnic minorities. Check in with facial recognition now possible in Shanghai. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the VOAnews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A commentary in the state-run North Korean KCNA news agency blasted the United States for not lifting sanctions, calling it a sign of Washington's continued hostility toward Pyongyang. The writer called on the Trump administration to take corresponding steps in response to what is called the North's major conciliatory actions of the past few months. The commentary was published as both the United States and North Korea have met to plan a second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, likely after the November 6th U.S. elections. Meanwhile, South Korean President Moon Jae-in is visiting several European countries to drum up support for his rapprochement with Pyongyang. Also Tuesday, representatives of both Koreas and the United Nations met at the truce village of Panmunjom for the first trilateral talks on easing tensions within the so-called joint security area. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Middlebury Institute of International Studies Senior Research Associate Joshua Pollack, who said this is a process of carrying out agreements reached at last month's inter-Korean summit.
It seems to be rolling the clock back to the way that the Panmunjom area was managed before the so-called axe murder incident in 1976. Before that time, the military demarcation line down the middle of the DMZ was not enforced in Panmunjom, and anyone admitted to that area could roam around freely within the area, whether they were coming from the north or the south. They could mix and talk and interact as they saw fit. There were guards from both sides. But after the killings of American officers by North Korean troops in the DMZ, the current arrangement was established with a line right down the middle. So it seems that the Panmunjom area, the joint security area, is going back to the old arrangement with no dividing line down the middle. And everyone who is admitted to it can roam around freely. The guards will not be armed, and they will come from both sides.
Would this make it easier for defectors?
It might. There were North Korean defectors in the past who went through Panmunjom, but I assume that the North Koreans will make an effort to control who gets admission to the area more tightly.
And that includes the truce village of Panmunjom and its surrounding environs, but not the entire border area. That's still pretty heavily armed.
This is just one little bubble within the demilitarized zone. The joint security area is more or less synonymous with the truce village of Panmunjom.
The two Koreas on Monday agreed to begin reconnecting rail and road links.
That is an agreement that they had reached initially after the first Moon Kim summit at Panmunjom earlier this year. It's causing a bit of a stir because the United States seems to believe that this would require a sanctions waiver, which I don't believe the South Koreans have sought at the United Nations. The United States would be liable to block it if they did. So perhaps they have some interpretation of how this does not violate sanctions, or they have found some mechanism, some way of steering clear of a sanctions violation in implementing this agreement.
Joshua Pollack said President Moon's visit to France, Italy, Belgium, and Denmark appears aimed at Security Council members and a bid to pursue sanctions relief for North Korea, in apparent contrast to Washington's demands the sanctions remain in force until denuclearization is achieved. He said Seoul and Washington should work out a common approach and avoid any kind of discord in the Security Council. Happening now in Asia, a senior Chinese diplomat in Pakistan has taken to social media to reject as baseless Western allegations that China is committing massive human rights abuses in its neighboring northwestern Xinjiang border region. Beijing is blamed by the U.S. and international rights defenders for reportedly running mass detention centers. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. A joint Afghan and French archaeological team is getting closer to identifying what is believed to have been the ancient city of Gulgula, located in central Afghanistan's mountainous Bamyan province. The archaeological team is hoping to unearth proof of this ancient trading hub. VOA Afghan Services' Zafar Bamyani has filed this report, narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
A team of archaeologists has been working in Bamyan for more than 3 years in search of evidence of the historic city called Gulgula in the shadow of the towering, now destroyed Buddha statues.
Our work here is to see who lived there, in which time, and how they lived here.
The project is led by renowned archaeologist Julio Bendezu Sarmiento and his French team. It's funded by the Italian government and monitored by the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Bendezu Sarmiento says initial findings reveal that Gulgula was a strategic hub for trade in the region.
People coming from everywhere. This was a very big place in this time because it is the main route for to go between the north to the south.
Additional findings indicate the city was thriving from the 6th century up until the 12th or 13th century.
Of course, we know that it's Islamic, but maybe there is more ancient, maybe Kushan or, I don't know, Sassanid occupation on the site.
Assisting the French team are five Afghan archaeologists from the country's Ministry of Information and Culture, along with 20 university students.
After we are done with the excavation phase, we will begin the process of renovation and development in hopes that we shine a bright light on our ancient history.
In conjunction with the excavation, the project plans to build a recreational park nearby and a highway connecting neighboring provinces in hopes of increasing tourism in the region. For Zafar Bamiani in Bamiyan, Afghanistan, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Coming up, dealing with a rising cost of trade. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
News from VOA Asia, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says he is considering recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving the country's embassy there from Tel Aviv. U.S. President Donald Trump officially recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital last December, breaking with long-standing policy. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, tariff troubles and outdoor workspaces are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Many U.S.-based companies asked to be exempt from U.S.-China tariffs this summer because their CEOs fear the tariffs would negatively affect their livelihoods and increase the cost of doing business. Among those are three Colorado-based firms now feeling the impact of the recent tariff war. Salewa North America is a manufacturing company that makes a range of outdoor gear and apparel. Much of its headwear is made in China and has been tariffed. Company owner Salewa Drew Saunders worries he might have to move his supply chains out of China soon if the tariffs last much longer.
It's going to be either a negative financial impact on us or on our directly on our customer.
Keith Johnson, the chief creative director at Elope, a company that designs, makes, and distributes accessories, says that customers are already complaining about the high prices. He is concerned that the next round of tariffs, which will climb from 10% to 25% in January, might force retailers to manufacture those items themselves.
You do the math, that's a lot of tariff on one hat. So if a hat costs us $4, we're paying over a dollar. It's too much. It makes it very, very difficult to stay competitive and keep manufacturing.
China is also a key export market for another Boulder-based company, Kokona. CEO Jeff Bowman employs around 20 people and worries about the sustainability of his firm and the people in China who will be impacted.
Ultimately, who loses? Those people who are sewing and cutting and sewing in China, they're losing.
China's exports accelerated in September, signaling that companies are rushing to get shipments out ahead of the upcoming tariff rate increase of 25%. Work environments in Japan are evolving and becoming more adaptable. Fuji Xerox and the Tokyo Metro System have installed satellite offices in major subway stations around the Japanese capital, hoping to cater to a mobile workforce. Fuji Xerox's black and white office pods can be reserved online at 200 yen for a 15-minute period. Snow Peak Business Solutions offers another unusual work venue, a camping tent. In Tokyo's Marunouchi Financial District, groups of business people sit on pillows in a tent surrounded by tall skyscrapers. Ryo Murasi is the head of Snow Peak Business Solutions.
I believe we humans should do something more emotional, inspiring, compassionate, and exciting. How do we do it? I propose that first we step outside, work under the sun, and chat with colleagues.
Teleworkers are also now fond of working in karaoke rooms. The world's biggest karaoke operator, Daishi Kosho, started the new service in April last year and opened up its singing rooms for office space at 33 outlets. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. China's transport minister wants to further boost cooperation with Central and Eastern Europe, where it is already financing infrastructure and other projects as part of a wider bid to increase global influence. The initiative is part of China's wider New Silk Road plan to boost influence in Europe and elsewhere in the world. Your road to top stories and great features is at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, as trade routes have crisscrossed the globe, plants and animals have hitched rides into new environments. Some immigrants have settled peacefully in their new homes. Others have become conquerors, wreaking ecological havoc and driving out native species. Many places are trying to rid themselves of invasive species, but occasionally these alien invaders carry a hidden upside, as we hear from VOA's Steve Barragona.
This reed is a bully. It's called Phragmites. This European invader has been muscling its way into wetlands across the United States. When Phragmites moves in, it drives most everything else out, says Christina Simcannon, a biologist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center.
It grows much larger and quicker than the native marsh grass species, and it can grow in really dense stands and basically outcompete the native marsh grass.
Some birds cannot nest in dense stands of Phragmites, and the stalks are too tough for some creatures to eat. Invasive species threaten coastal ecosystems worldwide, and the clean water, food, and other benefits they provide. But some invasives have at least one redeeming quality. They gobble up planet-warming carbon dioxide. When Simcannon and her colleagues added up data on coastal ecosystems worldwide, they found that overall, the ones overrun by invasive species contained about 40% more carbon than intact habitats. She says they were taken by surprise.
Yes, we were. I think because non-native species are often thought of as being negative so often, and they do have detrimental impacts. But in this case, they seem to be storing carbon quicker.
To be clear, Simcannon is not saying it's better to let the invaders take over. But dealing with them is not always straightforward.
It's complicated, which isn't a super satisfying answer if you want a direct, like, should we keep it or should we not? But it's the reality.
And the reality is not getting any less complicated. Smithsonian research shows Phragmites will have an even bigger edge over native species as temperatures and carbon dioxide levels rise. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Edgewater, Maryland.
Blind Paralympic cyclist Shawn Cheshire recently faced her biggest challenge, a rim-to-rim hike through the Grand Canyon. She and her fellow hikers spoke with VOA's Mike O'Sullivan about the experience.
68 kilometers of steep and uneven terrain, hiking through the night from rim to rim and back, finishing in just over 24 hours.
Sometimes in periods of the last couple of years, I've been on this desperate purpose of grasping as much independence as possible. And so for me, you know, being able to walk in the Grand Canyon like that, that's freedom.
Cheshire, who lost her sight after an accident 9 years ago, competed in cycling in the Paralympics in Rio and hopes to compete in Tokyo in 2020. She's training toward that goal. In the meantime, she was determined to finish this challenging hike.
I had a huge ball of emotion welled up in my chest. Like, I cannot believe we just did that. And just gratitude, just felt very humbled and very grateful.
Three friends helped her complete the trek, serving as guides and warning of obstacles. It appears that she broke a Grand Canyon record for a blind hiker.
We literally smashed it, and including going up the North Rim and down the North Rim, the entire thing, every trail that we were on, I've never actually gone that fast on.
It was an exercise in teamwork.
I've learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot more about the canyon.
For Shawn Cheshire, it was another accomplishment on the road to many others. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. As you know, we're all over the place online. You can find our program in many different areas, like Facebook. VOA Asia Facebook is a great place to find it and listen to it live as we stream each and every day. We're also on Facebook on VOA Burmese, so everyone in Myanmar who's listening to our program, we thank you for joining us today, and we invite you to come back again. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.